know by now that there's one thing I really long for the sweet smell of, and that's a great cup of coffee. Which is why I drink Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They have blends to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf, but the best thing about Sparkplug is that they deliver this delicious coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that fresh coffee order just takes care of itself. So what are you waiting for? From now on, the best of everything is good enough for you. So get started at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Grind me, Beverly.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hiya, podcast fans, and thank you very much for latching your ears onto the next 100 project, which explores movie classics. That exploration involves a myriad of spoilers, so consider your lovely selves warned right now. I'm that vicious smearmonger for a major metropolitan newspaper, Ryan Ellis, and here's my two-faced cookie full of arsenic, my sweet wife, Beverly.
That's me.
Oh, she's so sweet. And arsenic-laden. Okay, the coming attraction trivia for this week's picture, Sweet Smell of Success, one of my favorite movies of all time, and one of my favorite quotes is in this movie. It is, Match Me, Sydney. Longtime listeners of this podcast may remember what I've said is the single greatest movie quote of all time, and it's not on the AFI's Top 100 Quotes list. Gotta be a long-time listener, you gotta follow this podcast for a while to know it. I don't think I said it more than once or twice anyway, but what is it?
Oh, man, you gotta be married to him and then you still might get it wrong. Okay, I thought about this a lot. Is it? I am shocked, shocked to find there's gambling in this establishment.
That's very good. That's a great one. One of my favorites also. No? It's in The Godfather. I'm with you now.
Oh, God, you have said that so many times.
Just like Match Me, Sydney has so many meanings. We'll talk about Match Me, Sydney in the podcast, but just to finish up the Godfather quote, when Michael says that to Vito after Vito's been shot, it means, I'm literally with you, you're my father, I'll take care of you, but I'm also with the family, and that's the last thing Vito wants. That line is the whole movie. That's what Vito least wants, and in some ways does want. I guess he knows he'd be good at leading the family, but it's the last thing Vito would ever want him to do, and it's basically the downfall of the entire family when Michael decides to be part of it.
Simple line, but it carries a tremendous amount of depth.
Yeah. It's all about the multiple meanings and the depth, exactly. It's not really all that great a quote otherwise. Just like Match Me, Sydney is actually pretty simple, but a great quote. Okay, the next 100 Project's 67th title, Sweet Smell of Success, was not nominated for the 1998 AFI Top 100 list, but the AFI came to their senses and nominated it in 2007. But they still didn't put it on the list of those fuckers. In a curious choice, United Artists released the flick on July 4th, 1957, so this makes it 8 days shy of the 60-year anniversary. July 4th of this movie. Maybe that's one reason it bombed.
I was going to say, yeah, maybe summer audiences were in the mood.
Not for this. The critics and the crowds thought the movie was dog shit. Okay, Bev, explain this old movie for the fans with the skinny right now.
Tony Curtis is Sidney Falco, a cunning and desperate New York press agent with a lucrative quid pro quo relationship with influential gossip columnist and soulless bully J.J. Hunsaker, played by Burt Lancaster. That is, until Sidney fails to break up J.J.'s little sister Susie and her jazz musician sweetheart Steve. To get the job done and get back into J.J.'s good graces, Sidney has to go to some great lengths and stoop to some low lows.
Or, in a nutshell, fake news, hashtag sad, sad, just it sad, I'll say it sad again, sad.
That is both true and appropriate.
I think it is. Talk about bullies in your description there. Well, the ultimate bully's in office right now.
Yeah, he's not nearly as smart as J.J. Hunsaker.
That's true. All right, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 98% of critics like the movie, 46 fresh, only one rotten. One person is an asshole, and 92% of audiences. And lots of critics and polls have put this movie on their greatest films of all time list, including The Sight and Sound and Entertainment Weekly. But at the time, people were pissed, I think at least, that the movie revealed that showbiz is dirty as fuck. And also, they promoted this movie as starring the guys from Trapeze, the movie you loved last year, 1956. Well, Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis were a lot different in that movie than they were in this, so that was misleading and false advertising.
In a way, it was great casting because they're such great actors whose personalities are perfect for the role, but as far as the studios were concerned, it was a mistake casting because audiences were expecting the pretty boy and the strapping Burt Lancaster to be the heroes that they were used to, and on the contrary, they got two of the darkest characters in cinema.
I think audiences hated that they both played bastards. It'd be one thing if Lancaster did or Curtis did, but both of them playing them. And in the end, everybody in this movie seems to get what they deserve. And even Sidney Falco, he's a rat fuck himself, so to hell with him.
Yes, to hell with him. He's a bad person. You root for him because he's the main character and the movie does enough to get you to sympathize with him. But you sympathize with him the same way you sympathize with Michael Corleone. You just simply sympathize with them because they're the character that you're following, whose plight is the subject of the film, so you want them to win. But do you want them to win? Not really. Actually, you should be rooting for Susie and Steve to stay together, although Susie and Steve are pretty bland, who cares?
You characters. Are rooting for that, but they're yeah. dull, they're so boring. They're not the actor's fault, that's the way they're written. Although Susie, at the very end, she pits the two of them against each other. It's a pretty cunning move.
Oh yeah, she's not really 100% innocent. Because in the end, she has to be as dirty as them to win. Just to escape. To have any chance at a happy life. She has to stoop to their lows.
Yeah, it's not like she's taking JJ's money with her. She's taking a few things. She's almost take the closing fur coat. Her back, I guess. Yeah. Right. Well, that's something they point out online, that she's always wearing that fur coat until the end when she's not anymore, and that signifies JJ's hold on her is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's nice that when the movie starts, the break up the lovers scheme is already in motion. It's happened before the movie even began.
Oh, the pace is breakneck. Hit the ground running.
You gotta catch up.
Yeah, exactly, which is great. It forces you to pay attention. It's not actually hard. Well, it's somewhat challenging to catch up and keep up.
The details of what are hard to figure out. The overarching theme is not hard at all, of course. Yeah,
agreed. The characterizations of our protagonists are plain to see.
Yeah.
Whether you can follow the plot or not, you definitely are going to get the gist of what this movie is about, which is bad people. The world is a bad place.
Who also do a job that is necessary, but not necessary. You know what I mean?
It's not at all
Somebody
necessary.
Writing about Broadway stuff, and sometimes politics. Obviously, JJ gets into that too, but his main job is to be a Broadway critic and then a press agent. I'm not trying to rip on those jobs, but they're not vital people.
Just because there's an appetite for that work that they create doesn't mean that there's a need for that work that
just
they
like
create.
Steve is a jazz guitarist.
Yeah, that's kind of a good point. Just because
he's an artist, and that's a relevant job, but not necessary.
Well, you don't have to hurt people to make jazz music the way that J.J. Hunsaker, no matter what he does, if he's going to do his job well, he has to hurt people, and he has to drag them through the mud.
I guess why I bring it up, though, to criticize that is, not that I'm criticizing the movie, and the movie's fully aware of this, I think, but that you've got these people that really, in the grand scheme of things, aren't worth shit. Who really cares about a Broadway columnist? If there was an apocalypse, JJ actually maybe would survive, and for that matter, Sidney might, because he's such a little rat.
Just the but, cunning, yeah.
But those kinds of people don't do a job that's relevant. It's like that scene in The Simpsons. Well, Homer, you can run the power. Yeah, I can do that. Homer's useless. Homer would not be relevant in the apocalypse, and neither would these two guys, unless
neither
they
would
find
us.
Some other jobs.
Like,
well, yes. Podcast might not be relevant in the podcast.
Who's going to make classic film podcasts? You need to keep us around.
Well, Serial might live on through some kind of... Them and the Cockroaches. Serial and the Cockroaches all through
Who's gonna
the apocalypse.
Spoil dogs and talk about classic films?
Yeah.
You need Beth and Ryan.
When the movie begins, one thing I love about this, the first shots are of Times Square. That's not what I love. That's fine. But you see an ad for Canadian Club Whiskey, and that's my brand.
Yep.
If they remade this movie, though, it would be filled with four-letter words, and I've already used a few of them in this podcast because this movie wants to swear so badly. It wants to be the Glengarry Glen Ross of 1957.
It would be like Martin Scorsese levels of language made today, for sure.
Also, isn't it curious, and of course, 57, this was very much a thing, both radio, television to some degree, but newspapers especially were a very vital part of the society. But the vitality of a newspaper, JJ's job, that's dead now. Well, mostly at least. But JJ would be Bill O'Reilly, Rush Limbaugh, those kinds of guys. And he does have a TV show, but it's not as important a part of his job as his newspaper job is.
Although he's a gossip columnist, so maybe he would be more like Perez Hilton or...
But he's mainstream.
Just Jared. Yeah, he would have a website. He would have a blog. And those people are powerful. They do wield a certain level of power. Right.
But they don't do it through print anymore, and that's what I'm saying.
No, you're absolutely right. Doesn't JJ have like a TV show?
That's what I'm saying, a TV show. The scene where he says, "I'd hate to take a bite out of you. You're a cookie full of arsenic." That's at the TV studio before his show goes on the air. And that's also when Sidney does match him, if you will. He provides the match. And now he's on JJ's side. And that's also when he is very subtly working Steve against Susie and making JJ look like the bad guy, but also making himself look like the bad guy. No, he's not actually making JJ look like the bad guy, I should say. He's making himself look like the bad guy very smartly. Sidney's not dumb.
No, them together they have this, like, vile intimacy. They share no love, but they share these goals, and they share this cynical worldview. And their scenes together, when they're working together, they just crackle. Like, you learn everything you need to know about these two characters when they fall into sync, like in that scene. You know, there's this back and forth where JJ's mad at Sydney, and Sydney hates JJ, but he's still trying to win back his favor, and there's something adversarial about the relationship. But when they're working together, it's just a sight to behold. And Sydney needs JJ for obvious reasons. The less obvious reasons that he wants to be JJ. He thinks he has a lot to learn from him. But he has to, in the immediate moment, kiss his ass in order to do his job and succeed at his job. JJ needs Sydney, too. Because his ego requires this lapdog. He needs this constant reminder of the power he wields.
And Sydney thinks he can write the column, which is an interesting touch because... is Sydney actually qualified to be a writer of any kind?
Right? Until the moment he offers in the column, it doesn't even occur to you, oh, he wants to be where JJ is.
As a gossip columnist, not just involved, but taking over the column for a matter of months, according to JJ.
He might have a different style from JJ. He would definitely have a different style from JJ just simply because he is so much more charismatic than him. But do you doubt for 1 second that he would be any less evil than JJ?
You know the difference between these two is they're both bad, but I think Sydney has a conscience. He just buries it, unlike JJ, who has no conscience at all. So I do think he might be a little bit better. He does pimp out somebody who's in love with him, and that's terrible, obviously. But I think he feels bad about it. He just doesn't allow us to really see that. Maybe some glimmers. JJ in the same position would probably do it and wouldn't blink.
Why do you think he has a conscience? I don't think he has a conscience. I don't think.
I think there are a few moments. Okay, well, here's the question then. He's fine in the movie. But is Tony Curtis maybe miscast because he was never a great actor? This was a great run for him. He did this movie. The next year he did The Defiant Ones with Sidney Poitier. The year after that, Some Like It Hot. The year after that, Spartacus. Whether you like those movies or not, that's a career. And he did other movies too, but that's an incredible little run there. Mm-hmm. And then he and Lancaster are producers on this film too, so he was getting some power. But if he's miscast, and I'm suggesting maybe he is, that Brooklyn accent a little bit strong. Not that there's anything wrong with that. The movie's a New York movie.
He's you see
outdoor New York
yeah.
scenes. Actually, that's an appropriate thing, too, isn't it? Maybe he's supposed to be from the borough, so he doesn't count as much as a Manhattan guy. But I'm just saying, is Tony Curtis, who's a bit of a lightweight as an actor compared to a Burt Lancaster or a lot of other guys in that era, maybe not the right choice for this? Because I do think I see some moments in his performance where he's conflicted, but a better actor maybe brings it out even more, a Monty Clift or somebody like that.
Okay, so this is my take, because I disagree with you. Curtis, incredibly charismatic. When he turns it on, and he turns it on in this film, I could fall in love
with him. And a heartthrob as well.
And a heartthrob, yeah. I think they actually say, they call him eyelashes. Somebody, one of the secretaries is like, these are their eyelashes. He's gorgeous. He's a great-looking man. He has this incredible charisma that he pulls out when he needs it in this film and puts away when he doesn't. And I would say that a lesser actor would have pulled his punches and relied on that charisma to give the character sympathetic touches, to make the audience sympathize with Sydney and make him a more relatable character. But as Curtis plays it, the only thing that makes him relatable is simply that he's not as evil as JJ. Or not relatable, but redeemable. Because I don't see these touches that you're talking about, these moments that he feels guilty about what he's doing. When he has Rita in his apartment and she's expecting to meet him and then he instead pawns her off, when someone else talks her into doing something.
The other gossip columnist.
The other gossip columnist. And when I say pawns him off, I mean pimps her out to sleep with this
man. She's supposed to fuck the guy, yeah.
You might sense that he regrets that he has to do this, but that doesn't stop him from doing everything he needs to do. It is a terrible thing he does in that room. By using his charisma, by using pressure to get her to do something she clearly doesn't want to do, to sleep with this, not total stranger, but close to a stranger, and he's happy when he pulls it off. I do not see remorse in that scene, and it's probably one of the very worst things he does in the movie.
I agree with that. I don't deny what you're saying, except that I think Curtis plays a few moments with that and with his secretary, played by Jeff Donnell, I guess is her name. Jeff, yeah.
Oh,
she
wow.
plays Sally. I thought I saw some moments where he's giving a bit of a flicker, just enough. And I'm thinking maybe a better actor would give, yeah, maybe you're right, maybe it'd be too much. Maybe Curtis needs to play this guy as much of a bastard. Maybe a Monty Clift, for example, would have played him too sympathetically. That's very possibly true. But Burt Lancaster plays JJ as a complete shark. It's straight ahead. It's eating people. There's no subtlety there, even though it's a great performance, I think, for a very small performance, too, because Lancaster's not in the movie for something like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's only about 96 minutes long in total. So I think I see him doing little things that make him feel even a tiny bit guilty, and that's more than JJ would do. One of the influences from this movie is on Jerry Maguire, because Tom Cruise said he tried to play Jerry based on Sidney Falco. And I love Jerry Maguire so much. It's a fun movie. It's funny. It's romantic. It's a good sports movie. It's all those things. I've watched it many times. I'll watch it many more. But Jerry is a sports agent. It's supposed to be incredible at the job before he gets fired for having a conscience. I'm not criticizing that movie for playing it that way, but that movie does go soft. He's too much of a nice guy, maybe in some ways, compared to especially Sidney Falco.
And it hits a different note from what Sweet Smell of Success does. Yeah. So it's like a movie that I find satisfying and fun to watch and heartwarming.
But everything works out in that movie.
You watch that movie and you get a different reward out of it than you get from Sweet Smell of Success. I can see how he plays some scenes with that cutthroat desperation that Sidney Falco has. And apparently it's a line amongst press agents that they say they're going into Sidney Falco mode.
Okay, yeah.
Because when you're desperate and you just have to do anything you have to do, then you're in Sidney Falco mode and you just turn on the charm and you don't let your scruples get in the way.
Well, you got to admit, Sidney does his job and does what it takes to get his clients press.
And I agree with you that I think there are moments that he hesitates to stoop to a brand new low, but once he commits, he has no remorse. Mm. And that's why he's just as evil as JJ. He's just a different personality in a different place in life. He's not a shark, but he is...
A barracuda?
A barracuda, thank you, yeah. What's a more charismatic animal that will still eat you alive?
Sharks have charisma out the ass, man. What are you talking about? It's almost Shark Week, in fact. Maybe it is by the time we put this podcast on the air.
Charismatic sharks.
Well, the column that Sidney wants to take over, well, I guess he's not really gunning for that spot, but when JJ offers that, he sure wants it. Is the New York Globe, the Eyes of Broadway, as JJ's column's name, and he has, or at least the paper does, 60 million readers in 1957.
That's incredible. And that's worldwide, I think, too.
And that's why he wants the job. Sidney also works near a pawnbroker. You can see the sign at one point when he goes back in his office. And I suggest that's, well, it's probably just part of where they got the set. They did shoot in New York, a lot of this movie on the streets. But he's probably hawked everything he owns. It looks like the guy sleeps in his office, and he's got that Sidney Falco press agent, I guess it says, taped up to his door, so official. All right, the Match Me line. I've mentioned this before, and here's finally the movie we can talk about it in. Match Me Sidney when they're sitting there, and JJ's talking to the senator, who's obviously fucking the young blonde, who's fronting that she's with some other guy. That line means, I think, four things. Obviously, it means, light my cigarette, please. Mm-hmm. Not saying please. The tone is, light my fucking cigarette, toady.
Yeah.
The third one is, can you match me what I'm doing right now? Are you good enough to match me at this? So maybe not four things, but three meanings in one three-word line.
It conveys so much information about the relationship. And in it that also... moment. And what does he respond? He's like, not right now, JJ. Although plenty of other times he is JJ's
lapdog. Well, he does light his match later on.
Yeah.
Or lights the cigarette, I should say, in the scene where they're both trying to screw over the Susan-Steve relationship before JJ goes on TV. But the Match Me line follows insults to Sidney as well. And maybe that's part of the reason why. So Sidney's trying to be tough in front of these guys.
Although there's plenty of times when JJ just tears him a new one and Sidney just sits there with this perfectly placid expression on his face. Another reason you might read him as a bad guy or just a sociopath, he seems to let JJ walk all over him and he has this super detached way of reacting to all of the insults and injuries that would make a normal person's blood boil.
I think that's showbiz for you, though.
Okay, but maybe you have to have no conscience or scruples or anything to be in showbiz. You have to have such a thick skin that eventually you're not really human anymore.
Yep. From what I've heard, in a lot of cases, maybe not always.
But yeah,
yep.
Yeah.
And as for the whole thing with trying to get Steve out of Susie's life when they do the whole communist thing and give him the pot, it was so easy to frame a guy back in the 50s, and it kind of would be now, actually. Maybe not so much pot because it's becoming more and more illegal. But the dope-smoking communist is still a life-ruining piece of dirt, in the opinion of some people. A lot of people, in fact, especially in America. And it certainly was the end of your life, or your career, or whatever you wanted back then. Steve is leaving New York at the end of the film.
Yeah, that's right. It's used again in L.A. Confidential. That's how they want to ruin that actor's life to get him under the heel.
So it's all about reputation. Now, one of the great lines in this movie, and we'll talk about all the lines that should have made the top 100 quotes list at the end, but one of the great ones is, the cat's in the bag and the bag's in the river. Now, that can mean a lot of things, but I think one of the things it could suggest is the cat refers to Steve, who is a hep cat. He's a jazz guitarist. And is that one of the reasons why JJ hates him? He's cooler than me.
Well, I think he hates him because he's banging his sister.
And that's the other thing. Because one of the other influences is, just like in Scarface, both the old version of Scarface and the newer one, Pacino, the subtext of, I want to fuck my sister.
Maybe Chinatown to some extent, too. This twisted power incest thing going on. Susie's clearly quite a bit younger than JJ. Yeah. I'm surprised that more of the reviews don't straight out mention how creepy and weird and insidious their relationship is. Why does he care about his little sister at all? This is a man that cares about nothing. But he needs to control her, he needs to have her in his life, and he has this jealousy of her that is not sibling-like, it is not fraternal, it is romantic. He treats her like his lover. And then she looks at him with this mixture of fear and disgust. It seems so strong that from the very first time I saw the movie, I'm like, obviously, he's fucking his sister. Obviously, they're...
Or really wants to if he hasn't actually ever done it.
Well, he does something to her to keep her under his thumb.
Money's got to be part of it. Maybe she's more shallow than the movie ever shows. Why? And she wants to be kept well. She's wearing that coat till the end.
Why do you keep your little sister that well? You're a person that cares about nobody. So their relationship... Maybe
for even a great bad guy like him, you got to have some redeeming aspect. It's like Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs. Seems to care about Clarice. He actually does help Clarice. He does give her advice that helps her break the case with Buffalo Bill. So maybe it's the same deal. You got to give him one redeeming characteristic. And as bad as it is that he wants to bang his sister, or maybe has been banging his sister, he also does seem to care about her. He just doesn't handle it very well and doesn't do it right at all. Mm-hmm. I love the touch at the end when she's going to go to leave and he puts his hand on the door and you can't really see the hand, but you can tell he's in a position where he could easily push it shut. And it's Burt Lancaster. He could overpower most guys in the world, let alone this little woman. But she opens the door. He doesn't actually push it. I love the touch. If you could get on the other side, you'd probably see Burt Lancaster physically holding it but not actually doing anything. He could easily overpower her. But it's like she's mentally overpowering him.
She's won by stooping to his level. Maybe part of what he loves about her is that she was innocent. And then for her to pull the dirty trick, like lure Sidney Falco to the apartment and then pretend to try and kill herself so that he would catch them together so that they would fight with each other. I guess just to free up some space for her to get away. Mm. And aspects like she's not wearing the coat anymore, or even just everything that happens in the film, that she's drawing away from him. And it doesn't matter if Steve's going to prison or not. She needs to get away from him. And he knows that no matter what he does, he's lost her. I don't think most people in that position probably would give up that easily, but it's a film and they need to wrap it up. And it's the one little nugget of redeeming hope.
That the two lovers get away?
No, the two lovers do not get away. Steve's going to prison. He got caught with marijuana.
Oh, that's true, isn't it?
Yeah. No, the lovers don't get away. Susie gets away. We do not know what's going to become of her.
She's going to him, though. She says she's going to go to Steve.
Okay, but she is 19 years old, and he is going to be charged with drug possession.
And he's supposed to be a commie, which is also bad back in the 50s. Yeah,
so who knows what's going to happen to her. Her life is actually really, really up in the air, but we do know that she has this determination to get away.
Okay, so backing up into the Match Me Sydney scene would be when the senator says to JJ, why is it that everything you say sounds like a threat?
Yeah.
And that's the kind of guy that J.J. Hunsucker is, just like the Bill O'Reillys and Rush Limbaughs of the world are. You can't have a conversation with people like this unless it sounds like they're either going to physically or verbally beat you up.
And he wields a tremendous amount of influence against politicians and actors' personalities.
Yeah, I love that. Politicians. It goes beyond his Broadway column.
He's a senator, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Gotham columnist that has the upper hand.
Yeah, clearly. And the conversation goes on before the scene even starts. Just like when the movie starts, Sydney's supposed to be breaking up Susie and Steve. By the way, I just realized that. Sydney, Susie, Steve, JJ. Oh, yeah. Three S's and a J.
Yeah.
If Sydney has any redeeming virtues, then the three S's have redemption of a sort. But J does not. JJ does not. Now, at the end, when he finally decides to destroy Steve, and that's his ultimate downfall, JJ wins because he gets rid of Steve with their ploy before the TV show is supposed to go on the air, where it's the cookie full of arsenic scene. But his ego, and he even admits this, needs to destroy Steve, and that's what backfires on him. He's won, but it's not enough.
So he was based on a real Gotham columnist, Walter Winchell, who was a very powerful and influential Gotham columnist. Didn't have a little sister, but he had a daughter named Walda. Walda? Yeah, I know, right? Walter and Walda. Like, he just couldn't stand that he didn't have a son. And he loved his daughter very much, and she got caught up with, not a musician, but like a hustler named Bill Kahn. And Walter Winchell hated this guy and was constantly trying to break them up to the point where he threatened her with a gun and threatened to cut her off. She would apparently spend all of her allowance on this guy, and he got into trouble and notoriously sold her fur coat that was a gift from her parents to finance
this. This is becoming like Citizen Kane.
It is so much like Citizen Kane. And again, newspaper guy. A lot of people suspected this was a naked telling of that story.
I wonder if maybe that's why the critics also said they hated the movie, whether they actually did or not, because they had to distance themselves, and so did Hollywood, from ripping on a guy who could try to destroy them all.
I mean, I guess critics could have hated the movie because it was so cynical. It's such a dark view of the world. But I find it refreshing and crackling and amazing. And it could be because it was just too shocking to see these heartthrobs.
Oh, I think that's a big part
of it. Yeah, in a way, they were miscast just because of their personas. And that could be why audiences hated it too. But I don't think it was that long before people started coming around to it and recognizing it. It is a masterpiece.
And that was a great year anyway, but it was a great year for tough movies like 12 Angry Men. Well, it's not as tough. That's more cut and dry. But Bridge on the River Kwai, for sure, where you're actually siding against the main character, Alec Guinness. What have I done? This guy's gone nuts and he's done the wrong thing. He's actually collaborating with the other side. Seventh Seal was that year. We covered that a few months ago.
Oh my God. It was a deeply cynical year. Paths of Glory as well, which we recently talked about. Dark, bleak views.
And almost all those movies were also black and white, just like this one is. So it gets to be more of that shades of gray in a movie that's all about, literally, shades of gray.
Man, 1957 must have been a dark time to be alive. It's like people were just finally waking up from their World War II hangover or something. And
yet the Reagan people, both in the 80s and the modern era, all want to go back to that era because it was so great.
Man.
Well, at the end of the film, how vicious are JJ's reviews going to be now that Susie has left him? Is he going to tear into everything? This be one of those kind of guys? Because he's going to be so broken and ruined and hate everybody.
What kind of like a mean, cruel bully will he become without his sister to temper him at all? Maybe it'll finally be his ruin. Even Bill O'Reilly got taken down.
Yeah.
You can only be so awful to every single person around you you'd sabotage yourself.
And it looks like Jay just sits up very late at night drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes, so maybe that'll take him down before anything else does, too.
A lot of people did that back then.
Well, that's true. I actually was looking very carefully to see if he ever eats in the whole film, and he does have one scene where he's eating, but almost every time you see him, it's either smoking or drinking coffee or both. And a lot of people live on coffee and cigarettes. There's even a movie called Coffee and Cigarettes, but he does have at least one meal scene.
He's always just sitting and looking foreboding with the shadows from his glasses falling over his eyes.
You can't really see his eyes very well, can you?
It's nice touch. That was like an intentional choice by the cinematographer who was
James Wong Howe, one of the greats.
Thank you, I can remember his name. Yeah,
that's brilliant. Did the media always know about Dirt, like the senator fucking the young woman but fronting that she's with the other guy, but they buried it? Or as in this movie, they blackmail people. Now we just hear everything. Well, maybe I'm sure not even. There's plenty of things we don't hear about people. But we hear about so many things. All the dirt you hear about people like Bill Clinton back in the 90s and all the people now, one little thing comes out and their career could be over. Trump's political career should have been over, some of the things we found out about him. But the media apparently knew about Roosevelt and especially Kennedy fucking women three at a time back in their day. But no one ever talked about that in the media. It only came up many years later.
And the difference between the climate now and the climate then is when scandals do come to light now, people just underreact. When everybody has a sex scandal that we know about, how can you possibly get outraged about a sex scandal? It waters everything down. And it means that there's going to be a whole generation of politicians for whom everything they've done is going to be online from the age of 15 on. Everybody's going to have scandals, and it's just going to lower the bar completely until it's obliterated, and we're all just going to have to forgive all of our foibles. So the gossip columnists today would have very little power because I think we just know about everything now.
And we all share everything on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and even in person more than we used to.
And there's no secrets.
And a bit of a heads up, there's a thunderstorm out there, we think. Certainly a rainstorm going on right now. So if you hear any sound in the background, that's what you are hearing. It's also warm in this room, so let's not go on too much longer. We're going to sweat through our pants. Our shorts, I mean. All right, Burt Lancaster, great career. From Here to Eternity, which we covered way back when in the Top 100 Project. And of course, Field of Dreams, where he is so unlike this character. But he did so much great, strong work. He's top billed and has the juicier part. Do you agree with me that Burt Lancaster is Oscar-worthy in this film? For a supporting actor, probably.
This film is great because it has a great villain. He's incredible. Your description of him as a shark is perfect. He has enough depth to seem human, but he has this inhuman cruelty that's genuinely scary. Apparently, that's what he was like. That's what Burn Lancaster was like. He had a terrible reputation. There were people who quit the film or just never accepted jobs in the film because he was also a producer. Mm-hmm. And they were like, I'm not working for that monster. Are you kidding? He would threaten to beat people. He would beat people up.
Yeah,
he had a terrible reputation for being a J.J. Hunsaker.
But do you think he's Oscar worthy?
I think between the two of them, the two performances, I would choose Curtis's over Lancaster's.
I'm reversed, but okay, fair enough. Yeah. Susan Harrison plays Susie. This was her debut. She was only in one other movie, handful of TV shows as well. Martin Milner is Steve, sans Iwo Jima with John Wayne, mostly TV shows. So these other actors weren't in a ton of other things, except for M.L. Meyer, who we've covered now in Shane. He's one of the Riker brothers and recently Paths of Glory. And he's based on the cop Eddie Egan, who is what they based the cop from French Connection on. And he is a vicious bastard as well. He fits in with JJ quite well on being willing to just do the wrong thing and beat up Sydney at the end of the movie and do other things. Sydney deserves to get beat up, but maybe not quite like that and maybe not by that guy. I mean, if you want to fight him, JJ, fight him yourself.
And he's another character who just gets so much pleasure from performing his power.
And all these fine actors were directed by Alexander Mackendrick. I think I'm saying that name right. He was an Ealing Studios guy, so the English studio. He had done The Man in the White Suit and The Lady Killers with Alec Guinness before this movie, so that's one reason he got the job. But the budget got way out of control, and he was also blackballed. I don't know if that's because of anything to do with communist leanings. You always got to wonder about that in the 50s. I think he may have directed other films, but he never had anything like this again, this prestige project of this type, or even going back to England like he probably should have done, I suppose. He got a job at the California Institute for the Arts in 1969 and died in 1993, but he taught kids for a long time, so at least he found a good calling. But it's too bad his career was basically ended from this. Lancaster apparently blamed Ernest Lehman, the writer who did the novelette this is based on, for the failure of the movie. He bailed on it, and they got Clifford Odets to take over writing. And Odets apparently was a communist as well, or at least had leanings that way. Odets' polishing took months, so rather than him fixing the screenplay and getting back to work, it took a long time. They would do what they call wet ink shots. They would have to just go and have him write it, and then minutes later or an hour later be shooting the scene that he had just written.
I don't know how you can watch this film and look at that script and fault the screenwriter.
I know, it's a great screenplay.
Everything about it, the story is tight as a drum, but the dialogue
is outstanding.
On fire.
Yeah. But I didn't read in any of my online stuff that Lancaster or anybody really was blaming McKendrick for what happened in this movie. So if Lancaster didn't blame him, I have to assume he supported him. And if he supported him, as powerful as Lancaster was, why did McKendrick get blackballed that way? I don't really get it. I don't really understand the links, the math that got him out of Hollywood.
Maybe that's one of the things that we would know in this day and age that we'll never know because it happened in the 50s.
Yeah.
I thought McKendrick did an amazing job. I think he's an incredible director in this film. I mean, the performances, like we've said, were absolutely outstanding. But every decision he makes in this film is in the interest of increasing the tension and that incredible neurotic energy. It's very New York. They shot on the streets. They actually went to Times Square and shot there. Everywhere they go, it's crowded. People are bumping into them. They have to squeeze into spaces. They have to push people out of their way. The traffic is constant. It's dense. It's noisy. It's thoroughly chaotic. And the jazz soundtrack by Elmer Bernstein, frantic, fast, full of tension. The camera's frantic. It's moving all the time. It's relentless, and you're so caught up in it.
Ernest Lehman, who worked on North by Northwest, West Side Story movies we've also covered in the Top 100 Project, and other things too for that matter. I think Sound of Music is also on his resume. And yet he's got an awful lot of conflicts with people. He also was a producer and I believe a writer on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Yeah, he has incredible credits.
And yet apparently the final draft of that screenplay was not him at all. So I don't know what's going on here, but he had some big conflicts with a few different people. I know he was neurotic based on what I was reading about this movie, at least that he went off, just basically bailed on the movie. But the credits are great, whether he actually wrote this stuff in the end or not. He wrote the novelette, though, so that's something.
And he's the one person that I read who wanted to direct the film, was going to direct the film, but dropped out because he was so intimidated by Lancaster and simply didn't want to work with him that closely.
Yeah, Fox agrees. Well, Sidney sells his soul to be a writer, because if he gets JJ's column, then he's at least for a little while a writer. And that's a writer's touch. If you're going to sell your soul, it might as well be to write.
Writers love writing about writers.
They really do. Look at Stephen King. Almost forgot his name. The producer was James Hill, but he's part of the Hecht Hill Lancaster producing team. And then Kurt Lee Productions, and that is Tony Curtis and Janet Lee, his wife. Psycho's Janet Lee.
And,
so big-time production companies behind this movie.
And Jamie Curtis's parents.
That's right. Technically speaking, the movie is 1/6:6:1, so it's basically 1/8:5:1 on your modern TV. We watched the Criterion Blu-ray, which is black and white, and because James Wong Howe, who was outstanding, shot it, that's one of the reasons it looks so damn good. I think you agree with that, right?
Oh, yeah. It's incredible. Really brilliant cinematography.
One of the reasons I got this Criterion Blu-ray is because I wanted to get the bonus material on it. It wasn't so much for the quality, because I thought, well, maybe in the 50s, you don't really have to have it pop so much, but it does look better than the DVD I had before, I guarantee you. James Wong Howe shot Yankee Doodle Dandy, which we covered, a Top Runner Project movie way back when, and many others, of course. He was nominated for a lot of Oscars and won a few, I think it was. And he also shot Hud, which we are going to cover before next year is over, because that's 1963, and that will be the, 55-year anniversary? Another great black-and-white film. Paul Newman's in that. There's no editor credited, per se, but Alan Crosland Jr. is the editorial supervisor, and I didn't recognize that name, but I knew I should have, not Jr., but Senior, because Senior directed The Jazz Singer, the very first credited talkie in the history of movies. And speaking of sound, well, the musician, the composer, Elmer Bernstein, you mentioned him a minute ago, So many great credits for him. James Wong Howe, Elmer Bernstein. How can you go wrong behind the scenes with these guys? But Bernstein did To Kill a Mockingbird, The Great Escape. We've covered both of those, and also Magnificent Seven. So two of the most iconic scores of all time, with The Great Escape and Magnificent Seven.
Really different, too. He has a great range. Mm-hmm.
And then this is so different by being a jazz score, like you say.
The drummer, Chico Hamilton, he's in the band that Steve's in the film.
Yeah, it's the Chico Hamilton Quintet.
Yes, that's right. He's playing himself. He composed a score for the film that they ultimately discarded.
Okay. Yeah, it is the Chico Hamilton Quintet, yet Steve is the band leader. Is that white privilege?
Yes.
It's not his band. It's literally called Chico Hamilton's Quintet.
I think it's screenwriter's privilege because you want the character in the film to be the leader of the band.
He's a guitarist, and guitarists can be the leader, but usually it's a singer or someone. Well, I guess they don't really sing, do they? Anyway. Okay, the influence, and there's plenty. We mentioned the Jerry Maguire thing. There's also a 2002 musical with John Lithgow as JJ, and he won a Tony. So I can just imagine John Lithgow playing the character.
Great.
Probably not
casting
quite as well as Burt Lancaster, but then he's a great actor in his own right, John
Lithgow.
Yeah,
I would love to have seen that.
There's a character in Barry Levinson's Diner that's always quoting this movie. And when I saw Diner, I had not seen Sweet Smell of Success. So they mentioned that's the movie, but it meant nothing to me at the time. I should see Diner again to enjoy the quotes, because I'm sure he's using all of my favorite quotes. Another one I thought of just today, Glengarry Glen Ross. I may have mentioned this earlier in the podcast. If I didn't, I should have. Desperate Men Doing Terrible Things is one comparison, but also that snappy screenplay, and also a movie in Glengarry that is filled with fucks. Like I said, this movie wants to be filled with fucks. And maybe even fucking with Burt Lancaster. More implications, but they had to be more subtle with the code in the 50s. Maybe Burt Lancaster would have been more unsubtle about what he was doing with Susie.
Also, Vince Gilligan called Sweet Smell of Success his all-time favorite movie.
I thought Treasure Sierra Madre was his favorite movie.
Well, he has lots of favorite movies.
He's like Steven Spielberg, apparently has 15 ultimate number one movies.
I can relate.
Yeah. Well, I can't pick one favorite movie myself. I always say Jaws, but is it really my absolute favorite? I don't know. I guess it is. More influence for Sweet Smell. Whiplash, one of my favorites of the modern era. The ambitious sellout who'll do anything to please a vicious guru.
Yes, that's a great example.
And in the end, also, not a very happy ending, depending on how you look at it. And then that brings us to the awards and list section, which is relatively lengthy because I've got some things it should have been on. It got no Oscar nominations, but what about Lancaster for Supporting Actor, the music score, or the fucking screenplay? How did that not get nominated? But again, they had to bury the movie, probably not to piss off Walter Winchell, and also to say, that's not what this is all about in Hollywood and Broadway and show business, even though it was, I'm sure, probably
and
all along.
The Oscars rarely pay any attention to movies that fail the box office, no matter how good they are.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. This movie made the National Film Registry in 1993, and it's a great group of movies. All of these are on the Top 100 Project, so the AFI's Top 100 list. An American in Paris, Blade Runner, The Godfather Part 2, It Happened One Night, A Night at the Opera, One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest, Shane, and Yankee Doodle Dandy were all along with Sweet Smell in 1993.
Good company.
I believe His Girl Friday was also on there, but not an AFI film, but we did cover that last year. J.J. Hunsaker was 35th on the top 50 villains. Hannibal Lecter, who I mentioned earlier, was number one on that list. And by the way, Hunsaker, I wonder if that is supposed to be some kind of coy play on either cocksucker or motherfucker. Secker, sucker.
Yeah, I can see that.
It's got the same kind of rhythm, even if it's not the exact same letters, but it's pretty close. And the nominations for top 100 lists, or top 25 in some cases, the top 25 music scores was nominated for that at least, but didn't make it. Match Me Sydney was a nominee for the Top 100 Quotes, and why the fuck wasn't it on there? But also, The Cookie Full of Arsenic line wasn't nominated. The Cat's in the Bag and The Bag's in the River, not nominated. Or even just the simple line he says to Sydney about a third of the way through the movie, I love this dirty town.
Yeah.
Great moment, great movie. One of my favorites of all time. I've seen a lot, so I'll see it a lot more before I die. Your last thoughts on Sweet Smell of Success.
It's misleading to tell people this movie was made in 1957 because I think it still is crackling and current. I wouldn't let its age stop me from recommending it to anybody because it's timeless. It's a masterpiece. Oh, that script and those performances is excellent.
If I had to pick a top 10, it wouldn't make that probably, but it would make them a top 25, I think.
And it doesn't pull its punches, man.
I think twice we see Burt Lancaster looking out from his balcony to the city street below him. He's got this great place, of course. He's very rich. At one moment, he's still the king of New York, and at the end of the movie, he's not the king of New York anymore. I mean, everyone will think he is because they don't know what's gone on in his life the last couple of days with his sister and Sydney and everything else. But as we can guess, he's probably not the same guy anymore. He might even be destroyed, and that last look is pretty forlorn.
And his subjects better brace themselves for the backlash, the fallout.
It's going to be bad, but it's going to be great too.
Yeah.
All right, we'll be off next week to enjoy Canada Day, and you Yanks get to feast on the 4th of July. When we check in with you on July 10th, we'll review a movie that will be 30 years old that very day, and it's our second Stanley Kubrick movie in 2 months, Full Metal Jacket. So the coming attraction trivia for Full Metal Jacket. The drill instructor, played by Arlie Ermey, loves giving the boot campers nicknames. He says at least 5 different ones in the course of Full Metal Jacket. Name those, or even more if you can.
So for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast 2 weeks from now for Full Metal Jacket. And in the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. And while you're there, please check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and 2007 list of the best American films ever made.
A lot of which we've mentioned in this podcast.
Yes, that's true. We really have. Every single one of them is available for free. And while you're there, please rate us and write a review about us. It really helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we are both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Match me, Beverly.
And cut.
I don't smoke, so you really can't match me that way. The line has less meaning. Sigh.